And today I just want to spend a few minutes meditating on this passage to think about what is going on and what this teaches us about who God is and who we are. Now, this weekend marks the 14th anniversary of a legendary Niagara Falls trip that Sarah and I took along with her parents. 14 years ago, this August, we had just moved to Toronto. Her parents helped us move up there. We loaded up a U-Haul, a pickup truck in our car, crossed the border, made it into Toronto on a Friday night with the lights blazing in Little India, which was right where we lived. And so we had to navigate that. We found our spot. And in the course of unloading, realized that some things that we had brought with us, including our queen-size mattress, wouldn't fit up the narrow, low-ceiling stairway of the second-floor, partially attached place where we were living. So her parents graciously, after spending that weekend helping us get settled in and loaded, unloaded, agreed to come back the next weekend to bring a smaller size mattress and a few other things that we kind of had realized would be useful as we settled into Toronto. And so we spent Labor Day weekend together. I can't remember for sure. We probably went to a Blue Jays game. But then on Sunday of Labor Day weekend, we had the great idea, you know, let's load up in the car, and we're going to drive from Toronto to Niagara Falls. Really about a little over an hour drive, if there's nobody on the roads. Now, Toronto's the largest city in Canada. The little horseshoe around the lake there is basically completely populated with sprawl, so there are people everywhere. Plus, I guess it didn't go through our minds, this is Labor Day weekend. Apparently, everybody else thought going to Niagara Falls would be a good idea, too. And so as we sat in the car for hours in traffic, I was driving, and her parents were in the back seat complaining. This is what sticks out in my mind. Because, I mean, I have to deal with it now. I kind of expect it now with five children in the back seat complaining, why are we stopped? Why are we going so slow? But in my mind, I don't know if this is real or memory has kind of altered it, but the whole way there was complaining, right? Where did all these people come from? Right? This is the classic. Her parents would come to Toronto, a town of millions of people, and would just look around and be like, where did all these people come from? It's like, I don't know. You're in the largest city in the country. They're here. Right? So I recognize they're from a town of only a few thousand. So it's just like, why are there all these people on the highway? And so we get to Niagara, and the whole way down there, they're telling me, you know, we're going to have to pay to get in. We're going to have to pay big bucks to get to Niagara Falls. It's like, I've been to Niagara Falls. It's not like in a box. You can't just go through a gate. It's like Niagara Falls. It's huge. You don't have to pay. You might have to pay to park, but no, we're going to have to pay. We're going to have to pay. We're going to have to pay. Then we get to Niagara Falls, and you know, even there, right by the falls, it's just traffic jam. And her mom is, you know, every time we would pass, like, a piece of grass, why isn't that a parking lot? That should be a parking lot, right? This is, what it's Niagara Falls. There should be parking lots everywhere. No green space, just parking lots for people. So, you know, right? And it just went on. There was a certain point, you know, driving down the interstate where I was ready to just run the car into the ditch just to end it all right there. It was too much. So finally we get to Niagara Falls. There's no parking. It's crazy. And I'm like, this is it. I can't handle it. We're out of here. Right? We're leaving. So we kind of drove by the falls. You could just barely, if you craned your neck, see like the top, like 6 feet of the falls. And I was adamant, you guys cannot say that you've been to Niagara Falls and seen the falls. You may not say that. Because we didn't actually see the falls. Because I'm so sick and tired of this. We're turning around. We're going home. At some point, you know, this is fun. Maybe some of you experienced this with your parents or your kids. You know, Sarah turned around and kind of, perhaps in a foreshadowing of what's to come in our future, turned around and let them have it. Right? Like, what are you guys doing? We're trying to do this. We're trying to enjoy this. Like, so after that, I just remember silence. There was a lot of silence. I think we stopped at a Wendy's. We got back to our place. You know, we had left our place at like early afternoon. We got back to our house. It was dark. And they said, I think we'll go back to the States tonight. We'll just head on out. You know, that way they would avoid the traffic at the bridge. So this is a legendary complaining experience that has stuck with us, that is just etched in our minds, this Niagara Falls trip. Well, Exodus 17, we've seen the children of Israel complain already multiple times. But Exodus 17 and what goes on here becomes legendary in Israel's experience. And so let's read Exodus 17, verses 1 through 7. The whole Israelite community set out from the desert of Sin, traveling from place to place as the Lord commanded. They camped at Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. So they quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water to drink." And Moses replied, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you put the Lord to the test?" But the people were thirsty for water there, and they grumbled against Moses. They said, "Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to make us and our children and livestock die of thirst?" Then Moses cried out to the Lord, "What am I to do with these people? They're almost ready to stone me." And the Lord answered Moses, "Go out in front of the people, take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. I will stand there before you by the rock at Horeb. Strike the rock, and water will come out of it for the people to drink." So Moses did this in the sight of the elders of Israel. And he called the place Massah and Meribah, because the Israelites quarreled and because they tested the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" This is the word of God. Now, this experience becomes legendary. Psalm 78 references specifically Exodus 17 and this experience of quarreling with God and testing God. Multiple times, Psalm 95 references this. Psalm 106 references this. So no less than three psalms hearken back to this as examples of Israel's rebelliousness, unbelief, because of their testing of God in the wilderness. They test God. Furthermore, Deuteronomy 6, a little bit later, Moses is going to say to the people in Deuteronomy 6, "Don't test the Lord your God as you did at Massah and Meribah." Which, interestingly, this is the passage quoted by Jesus in the wilderness when Satan tempts him and he says, "Don't you know, don't put the Lord your God to the test." He's referencing Deuteronomy, which is referencing Exodus 17. You see this as well in Hebrews 3. The author of Hebrews hearkens back to Psalm 95 and says, you know, don't hesitate, don't test God, don't sit in unbelief, but today, soften your hearts, trust in Him. And so as I look at this, I think, well, what's different about this grumbling? I mean, we've seen in Exodus 15 and 16 that already the people have come to a place where the water wasn't good and they grumbled about that. Last week, Eric talked about how they grumble and God provides manna and quail. This week, they continue to grumble. Right? Grumbling children. So what's different about this grumbling in Exodus 17? What is it that makes this specific instance stand out? What makes it so bad that it's sung about and talked about as a prime example of unbelief and rebellion for over 1,000 years in Jewish history? And I think when we look closely at the passage, we can see what exactly is going on. What makes this grumbling so bad? When we look at this text, I want us first to notice the nature of their complaint. Okay, the first thing to see is the nature of their complaint. I think this is what makes it stand out as a particularly bad, a particularly problematic form of grumbling. What question do they ask? Moses says, what is it that's going on when they test God? I think you see this in the question at the end of verse 7. The nature of their complaint has to do with God's presence. Is the Lord among us or not? Is the Lord among us or not? This is a different kind of question. This is a different kind of grumbling than we see in earlier passages. If you glance back a page or two at Exodus 15, 24, when they come to the bitter waters, the people grumble and they say, what are we supposed to drink? Right, so they're upset. They're not happy about being at a place with bitter waters. But the nature of their complaint seems to just be more this, what are we supposed to do now? Right, we don't have water, God. With the manna and the quail, we see them grumbling and we see them saying, you know, we should go back to Egypt. It would have been better there. And so they're having these kind of false reminiscings about the past. But Exodus 17, I think, ratchets up the level of grumbling. Because now what's going on is the people are questioning God's presence. The people are questioning God's presence. See, we should expect that when they're in the wilderness, right, the wilderness is a place of testing. A wilderness is a place where you don't go expecting to be flowing with milk and honey. You expect it to be a place lacking water, lacking food. And so God leads his people into the wilderness, into this desolate place, a place that for many people they would think that, you know, this is the last place where God is. But the mindset of the Israelites is that if we lack something, then God is not with us. If our needs are not immediately met, then God is not with us. Why do we question God? Why do we question God? See, I'm getting ready to teach an intro to philosophy course, and one of the sections that we talk about in intro to philosophy is what philosophers call the problem of evil. If God is truly good, and if God is all-powerful, then why is there evil in the world? Why is there suffering? Why do people come like the Israelites do to this place and say, there's no water? Because if God is truly all good and all powerful, it seems like in any of these situations, God immediately would step in to make it right, to make things better, to take care of suffering, to take care of pain. Right? So from one perspective, it looks like maybe God is fully good, but he's not really all powerful. He can't do anything about this. He wants to help, but there are some situations where God is just limited. Or maybe on the other hand, God is all powerful. He could step in and do anything. But maybe he's not really good. Maybe he doesn't really want his people to be nourished and taken care of. Maybe he wants them to suffer in some kind of way. See, that's the philosophical problem of evil. And I think there is something of that going on here. But I think what the people of Israel are encountering is the real problem of evil, the real place where we start to question God is when we have experienced the goodness of God, when we know the goodness of God, when we know the power of God, and yet we're faced with a situation where there is no water. And we don't see an immediate solution. It's those times, it's times when we say, God, I recognize you acted in the past. I know that you were present with me in this time when I experienced your blessing, when you felt close, when you felt near to me. And so I know you can do it. I know you can step in. I know you can make everything okay. So why aren't you? Maybe you've abandoned me. Maybe you're not really with me this time. Maybe you were with me up to a point, but now you're gone. For me, that's the harder thing, because I know that in my own life there are times when I can see how God is involved up to the smallest detail of my life. Right? And I say, man, God worked in this way to bring this thing about that wasn't really a big deal, but it let me know that He was there with me. And so if I know that God can work in those small things and those little details, why doesn't God work in this big way to solve this big problem that I'm facing? And so the people are tempted. The people are tempted to question God's presence with them because of what they experience in the wilderness. Because they don't immediately see God acting to make things right. Now, notice as well, not only the nature of their complaint, but look at the focus of their complaint. This is interesting to me. In verse 3, the people were thirsty for water there, and they grumbled against who? They grumble against Moses, and they said to him, "Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to make us and our children and livestock die of thirst?" When we're in the wilderness, we tend to misdirect our complaints. Who do they really have a problem with? Who do they really have an issue with? It's not Moses. Moses is just the mediator. Moses is just the stand-in. See, oftentimes we take our frustration with God out on other people. We take our frustration with God out on other people. And so Moses here again comes under attack by the people because really their issue is with God, not with him. Now, I also want to say in this context, this is where I find many of the Psalms helpful. Because if you start to pay attention, when you read the book of Psalms, there are plenty of Psalms that start out with something like this: my God, why have you forsaken me? See, I think we oftentimes think God can't handle our questions directly. God can't handle our complaints directly. And so we start to blame anybody. This person who hurt me, this like Moses, this church leader who's taking the church this direction, I don't like that. Right? We tend to find other people on which to vent our anger. At the end of the day, we need to bring those complaints before God, recognizing that He can handle them. And so the focus of their complaint is on Moses. Now, when we think about the testing going on in this passage, this is interesting to me. Who is being tested? Who is being tested? See, God is testing the people, but the people are also testing God. They are asking God, "Are you really with us? Are you really present?" And this is the kind of testing, the kind of doubt that we often wrestle with. That it's not about questioning God's existence, it's about questioning God's goodness. Did you catch that? I think when people in Scripture wrestle with God, when they have doubts, it's not just kind of this abstract, well, is there a God or is there not a God? I don't really know how to navigate this. The question is God really good? Is God really good? See, we often say to God, as we might if we're insecure in other relationships, we say, prove it. I don't know if you really care about me. I don't know if you really love me. Prove it. God, you can't be here because of this lack, because of this need, because of this wilderness. See, think about, I mean, how would your relationship go? If you think about relationships with family members, with spouses, with other friends, how well would that relationship function if you were constantly asking people to prove that they care about you? See, I think we do this regularly, right? If there's somebody that we love, that we care for, I want to prove my love to my wife, to my children. But if I wake up in the morning and roll out of bed and my wife is sitting there with a checklist, here are all the things you need to do to prove your love to me today. Right? What would that do to the relationship? Right? What if I, you know, walked into my kids, all right, kids, time to wake up. Here's your list of what you have to do to prove you really love me today. What would that do to that relationship? And so this is why I think Moses later on in Deuteronomy 6, he does receive this word from God again, where he says, do not test the Lord your God. He's saying, recognize that God has already proved his love for you. Recognize that he has acted with this strong arm to deliver you out of slavery. He has provided for you every step of the way. And now you, Israel, are waking up on this day saying, prove it. Prove it again. Prove it again. Is God present in the wilderness? Moses knew, think about Moses. He knew that this was the place where he first encountered God. That God did not appear while he was in Egypt, while he was in the palace. God came to Moses only when Moses was in the desert, because it's when we're in the desert, when we're in the wilderness, that we recognize our dependence on God. That our dependence is not about the buildings that surround us, it's not about our family connections, it's not about our wealth, it's in the desert that we experience God's direct leading and a provision in a way that we often do not in the promised land. Jesus on the cross in John 19:28 echoes the people in Exodus 17. He says, I'm thirsty. I'm thirsty. There's no water. When we look at Jesus on the cross, if we can just for a moment, right, we're so used to seeing Jesus on the cross, if we can strip away what we think we mean by that, if we can see Jesus on the cross, we will recognize why most people look at that cross and look at this naked, tortured, crucified man and say, God cannot be here. God cannot be present in the midst of this absolute wilderness, this suffering, this pain. Which is why people say, Jesus, if you are who you say you are, prove it. Come down off the cross. Make everything better. Take away the thirst. Take away the pain. Fix it all now. Jesus, even on the cross, cries out to his Father and says both, my God, why have you forsaken me? But he also says, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. He was able to hold together this sense that God is not here, that it feels like God has left me, with this recognition that even in that place, God had not abandoned him and that his Father would be faithful to him. See, what if God is most present to us in our pain and in our suffering? In our wilderness, See, we want to solve poverty, and Jesus says, blessed are the poor. We want to wipe every tear away, but Jesus says, blessed are those who mourn. We want the world to be better now, today. But Jesus says, blessed are those who are hungry and who thirst for righteousness. We want to be victorious, living a life of comfort and peace and security, but Jesus says, blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness. See, the cross flips everything upside down. Jesus' proclamation of his kingdom flips everything upside down. And so as we gather together around this table this morning, this is the message that Jesus has for you. I am with you. Always. I am with you always in the joy, but especially in the pain, especially in the sorrow, especially in the brokenness. Jesus says, I am with you. And so as we gather around this table this morning, it's important to remember that this table has many meanings, has many layers of meanings to it. That as we celebrate this, we look back with remembrance on Jesus' sacrifice for us. That we look back and remember his body that was broken and his blood that was shed. He says, look at this and remember. But this table also has the meaning of communion, a reminder that this is not just a past event, but that he is present today with you exactly where you are. With whatever you are facing, with whatever questions you have, whether you feel like you've entered the promised land or you are broken in the wilderness, he is with you. But this table also points us in hope to the return of Jesus, who is coming back, who is faithful yesterday, today, and tomorrow. And so we celebrate this in hope. Well, we would invite anyone who is a member of a church who's been baptized into the family of God to join in this table with us this morning. We believe that we are united because of what Christ has done, and this table celebrates that. So as we celebrate this together, let's go to the Lord in prayer.